maybe I'll tell a little bit about the way it used to be as I remember it. And I suppose some of it is the way I heard it. I don't know. But, you know, long before the day of the refrigerator, the people did, of course, cut ice and put away ice and sawdust and preserve perishable food with ice. But then vegetables that were grown in the garden had to be kept through the winter months, long winter months, of course, up here. And they used to build what they called a greenhouse. Now this was just a little, usually a log structure, logged up in the side of a bank. No windows, covered over with ground, with a double door, that is, an outer door and an inner door. They put their turnips and carrots and cabbages and garden-grown food like that in this greenhouse. And that kept them surprisingly well-preserved in some state of freshness throughout the winter months. Also, in the valley here, there has been some notice taken by people from other areas about the number of dishes that we have here that are pork-based. There's a reason for that. We have a lot of pork-based recipes here in the valley because the early settlers here in the valley had no grazing land. We're only a couple of generations out of the log cabin up here. And the woods was very close to the back door. And it takes a long while to build up a herd of beef steers. Number one. Number two, cattle, for some reason, have a strange habit of not having their young in litters, but usually one at a time. So, domestic production of anything in the way of meat, you might say, was dependent mostly on the hog. And of course, you know, if you do not, then I'm telling you that hogs have their young in, anywhere from 4 or 5 to 18 or even more. So, almost everyone had hogs. They kept hogs. And in the spring, this was a source of pride among the neighbors. The hog. You come over and see my young hog that I have here, and see if yours is growing as fast as mine is. And then you, of course, reflected that. We had all these strange foods that we ate that were based on pork. Crapon. Boudin. Hirti. Pork feet. And all kinds of pork pies. So that was the reason, and that is the reason, that the valley here is still a place where recipes can be obtained for almost any kind of a pork-based dish. If you haven't sampled them, you should, because by and large they are delicious. I suppose the way was rough in those days, but I guess no one really felt that it was rough. By today's standards, undoubtedly, it would be considered rough. But I can remember my grandmother making candles. She saved the tallow and made candles. In fact, she made candles long after we had the kerosene lamps. I don't exactly know why. I guess just force of habit. The women used to knit in the long winter months. They knit, mostly all of them could do knitting, and many of them were very expert at knitting. What they called the sport socks that invaded the market at one time, the lumberjack wore those years before they ever hit the market. They had a pattern that they knit they called fox and geese. They had another one they called stitch around diamond. These are only two that I remember. But they could knit gloves, knit mittens, even whole suits of underclothing could be knit. The women knit them in the long winter evenings, and some of them by candlelight. Almost everyone had sheep, and the sheep were sheared in the spring, and the wool was taken to the carding mill, not a spinning mill, but a carding mill. There just were no spinning mills as such, but there were carding mills. The handiest one here was at Madawaska. In fact, if the people in Madawaska will pardon me, before the paper mill, there wasn't much of anything else at Madawaska except for the carding mill. Oh, I suppose I have not endeared myself to the people in Madawaska, but I'm just giving a little bit of historical fact. And I'm not trying trying to downplay any area, least of all Madawaska. It is the criterion of industry in the valley. But they would card the wool into long, loose rolls. Then those rolls would be brought back and the spinning wheels were busy then. The spinning wheel. Stories and songs. The spinning wheel. There's an old spinning wheel in the parlor. I saw those spinning wheels running. I saw them spinning the rolls into a single strand and then taking the strands, one, two strands, three, or sometimes four, and twisting them into the yarn that they were going to use to knit with. That was the way they got their yarn, the way they got their wool and yarn to make the mittens, the socks, or the stockings, yes, even the caps for the men to wear and the children in the woods. The roads, of course, were not plowed like they are now, and the winters, although they seemed to be more severe, were really not more severe. Records would prove that. But the distances were made much longer by the road not being plowed, and the means of travel was so much slower than it is now that a doctor 10 miles away, you can imagine the problem. Children with the whooping cough and the mumps in the winter. The mumps. We'd wear a little sacks of goose grease or something like that around our necks for the mumps. We had all kinds of strange remedies. My grandmother had one pantry wall lined with roots and herbs that were dried, picked in the summer, and dried and labeled and hung up there. And we used to say, well, grandmother's got her witch pot going. She'd have a dish on the stove and she'd be steeping some kind of a concoction to give us kids for some kind of an ailment that happened to be going, or imaginary ailment that was going. However, I think that I can say this and have people much more expertise in the field of medicine than am I to back me up, that these same old Indians as well as older herbs and remedies are the basis of many of our medicines that are used today. And so I think that we owe quite a bit to the preservation of these old recipes and these old remedies. We also owe more than we sometimes are aware of Indian, the American Indian, because had they not been here, times could have been much more rough in certain instances than they were. They showed the white settlers in this area how to eat fiddleheads. You tend to hear people now in New England that the fiddlehead belonged to all of New England. Why, my God, those people down around Bangor didn't know what a fiddlehead was not too many years ago. I don't mean all of them, but the fiddlehead is, as a New England food, is a comparatively recent arrival. They're canning them now in New Hampshire and selling them here in the supermarket for about 75 cents for a little can of fiddleheads. The fiddlehead is a fern, of course. But most of the people here in the valley grew up eating fiddlehead. The fiddlehead was introduced to the white man by the Tobik Indians, the Indians of the Tobik. And the Indian has shown the white man how to build canoes and how to sail on the streams. Of course, the canoe today does not fill the position that it once held. It is now more a object of recreation rather than necessity. At one time it was a necessity. I don't know how much I should talk, if I should talk very much more or not. How long does that go?
Just as long as you want to. It's halfway through.
Well, enough of the food and the way of life for most of the people. You know, they had fields of buckwheat that everyone grew a patch of buckwheat that had a patch of ground large enough for a patch of buckwheat. And almost every town of any consequence had a grist mill to grind it into buckwheat flour to make pancakes. And they took some of the hulls and the bran, as they called it, to feed the hogs. The buckwheat harvest was a great time for young people as well as the old people, or the older people. We'd have the buckwheat after we had gathered it. We'd bring it to a threshing machine and they would thresh the buckwheat and we'd put in bags or sacks that held about 100 pounds. And they were well woven sacks. Then it would come time some morning that your father would say, "Well, boys, I guess we'll take the grist to the mill today." Harness up the horses and load the buckwheat and go to the grist mill with it. There would be wagons and horses there when dresses as designer, Caribou. He would come out and he and my father would talk about the girth that we had on the wagon and when perhaps we could get it ground. We'd unload it and it would be piled by itself and marked in one corner of the room that he had to unload the buckwheat in. The mill would be running. It was a water-powered mill. The mill would be running and grinding someone's buckwheat into flour. And the men would be sitting in the yard on their wagons or on a block of wood, whittling and talking. And if he didn't have time to grind your grist that day, that was all right and rather welcome because you were going to come back the next day and do the waiting all over again and meet some other neighbors that are bringing their grist in on that day. And when they speak of the good old days, I think that's what they meant. That there was no great big driving rush to get there before someone else got there. You know, that seems to be the way today, is that you get up, you want to do something, and you read about something that can be done in the paper, maybe in the morning paper, and you almost break your neck getting there. When you get there, you're in a line, maybe, of 25 people that have arrived before you got there. And everyone rushes. Rushes here and rushes there. No one seems to have time anymore to do anything except rush. In those days, the men really did get up early in the morning, and the women too. I don't think that they stayed up as late after the evening meal, undoubtedly, as we do in general today. But they were up very early in the morning, and they were out and doing. But they certainly did have time. There was no whistle or gong that told them they had to be to work. There was no whistle or gong that said it was time to quit work. So no one kept that time with a clock watcher, really. I mean, that per se. An expression that developed later on, and factory workers went to work by the clock and quit by the clock. And they, in those days, they had time to grind their buckwheat. They had time to do all the things they had to do. Life may have been more simple. Undoubtedly it was. But it was much less complicated in the sense that it was more relaxed. There was more relaxation, I believe. Less nervous tension, undoubtedly. The buckwheat was ground. They made pancakes with the buckwheat. quiet in those days up here. Oh, they had plenty of fresh fish in the summer months because they could catch trout, usually just near their homes in any of the streams, and we have plenty of them here. And they could catch trout. And they would sometimes get a caribou or even a moose for fresh meat. Most of this meat that they didn't use immediately was they salted it to preserve it until they could use it. That was the standard method, I think, all over the world, perhaps, at that time, to preserve anything, or at least all over the New World, was to salt anything that you wanted to keep. The deer had not, as yet, arrived in northern Maine here. The deer, as you undoubtedly have heard, and most of you may know, there's quite a recent arrival in the northern part of Maine. It's believed mostly by most authorities that it migrated here from Pennsylvania. But it followed, apparently, the logging operation, because food in the winter is quite hard to get when the snow is deep, and around where the men were cutting the logs, there was buds and things from fallen trees that the deer could eat. Did have moose and caribou, and the caribou left this country. They were in herds. Why they left, I don't know. Perhaps it's like the disappearance of the old pumpkin pine. No one is really sure what happened. But the caribou were here in herds, and they left. They were not shot out, they migrated north. Whether the deer drove them, some people say that, I can't quite accept that. The moose that were plentiful at one time are coming back now, but in the eastern part of the United States, hunting the hunters and the game rifle almost exterminated and made extinct the moose. They are on the way back now, fortunately. I hope that they will not open the season on moose, because the moose is a very easy animal to hunt. It's the most majestic animal we have in the Maine woods. It's the most majestic animal we have in the eastern part of the North American continent. Protecting. We've lost too many of our animals already, from mostly ignorance and neglect. that's another story.